I'm John Strum, and this is Real Talk MS. It's April 2nd, and we have a lot to talk about. If you're a regular Real Talk MS listener, you've probably heard me say that the pace of research is moving faster than ever before. Or you may have heard the National MS Society remind us that we've seen as many advances in MS research in the past 5 years as we have in the previous 70 years. But have you ever wondered why? Well, a major reason behind this acceleration of discovery is technology. Specifically, the technology that allows scientists to analyze massive amounts of information, to look for relationships or identify characteristics that, without this technology, would be impossible to find. This technology is more commonly referred to as big data, and we're closer than we've ever been to understanding the biological complexities of multiple sclerosis and finding ways to mitigate those complexities because we've learned to harness the computing power that allows scientists to identify those very small needles in very large haystacks. My guest today is Professor Sergio Baranzini. Professor Baranzini is this year's recipient of the Barancic Prize for Innovation in MS Research, and he's someone who has leveraged big data to drive big, game-changing discoveries in MS. But before we get to my conversation with Professor Baranzini, there are a few other things that you should know about. If you've been following the news, you may have seen that in order to avoid a governmental shutdown last week, Congress passed a series of appropriation bills that President Biden then signed. And the good news for the MS community is that $20 million in funding for the MS research program for fiscal year 2024 was included in this latest round of appropriations. The MS research program is administered by the Department of Defense, and it's the only federal funding specifically designated for MS research. Congress also approved $48.6 billion in funding for the National Institutes of Health, which represents a $300 million increase from the 2023 budget. Included in this amount was $2.2 billion for the National Institute of Mental Health, $2.6 billion for the National Institute of Neurological Disorders and Stroke, and $1.5 billion for the Advanced Research Projects Agency for Health. Congress funded the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services at the 2023 level of $4.1 billion. The Food and Drug Administration was funded at the 2023 level of $3.5 billion, and the CDC's National Neurological Conditions Surveillance System, which was something that MS activists advocated for in the past, well, that was granted $5 million in funding. If you're thinking about becoming a part of the MS activist community, or you already are, I hope you plan to join the virtual MS activist rally on April 25th at 12 p.m. Eastern Time. You'll hear from keynote speakers, you'll be able to connect with other MS activists, and you'll have opportunities to engage directly with your elected officials online and learn more about policies that are moving on Capitol Hill. If you'd like to learn more about the National MS Society's MS Activist Rally, or you're ready to register today, you'll find a link in today's show notes. As we've discussed in previous episodes of this podcast, there's a growing interest in the research community to better describe MS by identifying specific biological changes that may be taking place in an individual's central nervous system. A German research team has just published a study that identifies three subtypes of MS that can be identified by specific immune markers that are found in a patient's blood, and each of these subtypes carries with it a slightly different disease progression. This work was led by Professor Heinz Windel, a professor of neurology at the University of Munster, who was interested in testing his hypothesis that MS patients have immunological signatures in their blood that can match up with specific but different versions of MS. The multicenter study involved 500 people living with early stage MS. These were people who hadn't yet undergone treatments that would have changed their immune systems. The research team assessed different populations of immune cells and then developed an algorithm to determine whether certain cell populations were more prevalent among the 500 study participants. Well, the researchers discovered unique immune cell activation among the study participants, and these different cell signatures corresponded to specific subgroups. They labeled the subgroups E1, E2, and E3. And by following the study participants in these subgroups for 4 years, they discovered that each of these subgroups had its own disease trajectory. Patients in the E1 subgroup had alterations to a group of immune cells called the CD4 T cell compartment. These are helper cells that can activate other immune cells and inflammatory proteins that have been associated with autoimmune disease. This group was associated with earlier structural brain damage, greater disease severity, and a higher level of disability. These are people whose MS seems worse right from the beginning. The E2 subgroup had alterations in the natural killer T cells. Now, these are the immune cells that are supposed to eliminate the sick cells in our system. The E3 subgroup showed alterations to CD8 T cells, the most inflammatory of the subgroups. This group had a higher relapse rate within the first year of diagnosis and more MS lesions that point to issues in the blood-brain barrier. The researchers also found more immune cells in the cerebrospinal fluid of members of this group. Understanding which group an individual diagnosed with MS might belong to could help predict their future disease progression. And while more research is needed to understand how these immune cell signatures might change or evolve over time, they were found to be stable in the handful of study participants who remained untreated, including up to 9 years within one of the study participants. The differences between these subgroups suggests that MS may arise through a multitude of immune system pathways and not just one. And perhaps because of these different immune system pathways, the subtypes responded differently to treatments. For example, the members of the E3 subgroup didn't respond to being treated by interferons, but these study participants did improve when treated by monoclonal antibodies, including Lemtrada and Ocrevus. As I mentioned a moment ago, there's lots more work to be done in further investigating ways to describe MS that leverage all that scientists learn as they continue to identify the biological clues and mechanisms that drive MS disease activity. But understanding how an immune cell signature that can be seen in a blood sample can predict someone's future disease course brings us a small step closer to the day when an individual's MS treatment plan can be personalized to address those specific mechanisms that might be taking place in that person's central nervous system. Now, if you'd like to review the details of this study, you'll find a link in today's show notes. Several studies have confirmed that MS relapse rate and disease activity decrease as an individual's age increases. It's also been speculated that treatment effectiveness may also decrease with age, while the risk of side effects may actually increase. As a result, we've seen a heightened interest in better understanding whether someone over the age of 50 needs to continue their disease-modifying therapy. There isn't yet a lot of research that addresses this specific question, but that's changing. And a research team from France has just published the results of their study, which showed that people over the age of 50 with non-active MS who discontinued a high-efficacy disease-modifying therapy had a higher risk of relapse compared with those people over the age of 50 who continued their high-efficacy DMT. This increased risk of relapse was highest for older study participants who discontinued Tysabri or Gilenya. Now, another study that we've discussed before, the DISCO-MS trial, found much lower rates of relapse after treatment discontinuation. But the participants in the DISCO-MS trial were older, with an average age of 63, and most of the participants in that study used older injectable disease-modifying therapies. In fact, less than 10% of the DISCO-MS study participants used a high-efficacy DMT. This latest study used data from the French MS Registry, identifying 1,620 people, age 50 or over, who were on a high-efficacy disease-modifying therapy between 2008 and 2021. The mean age of the group was 55, and 72.5% of the study participants were women. All of the participants had either relapsing remitting or secondary progressive MS and had shown no evidence of relapse or MRI activity in 2 years or more. All had been on a high-efficacy DMT for at least a year, and study participants were placed in one of two groups depending upon whether they had discontinued their high-efficacy DMT or not. These high-efficacy DMTs included Tysabri, Gilenya, Rituxan, and Ocrevus. And for study participants with relapsing remitting MS who discontinued their high-efficacy DMT, the probability of a first relapse within 1 year was 33.6% for Tysabri, 16.3% for Gilenya, and zero for those who had discontinued an anti-CD20 therapy. Relapse risk among the study participants with secondary progressive MS didn't increase when they discontinued a high-efficacy DMT compared to those study participants who continued their high-efficacy DMT. There's still much more work to be done here. One potential issue connected to this study is that the registry data did not indicate whether someone who had discontinued their high-efficacy DMT had then started treatment with another DMT. We can look forward to hearing outcomes from additional studies as the subject of aging and MS continues to generate increased interest throughout the research community. And if you'd like to review the details of this study, you'll find a link in today's show notes. Health Canada has given its approval for the commercial use of Aetna MS, a software-based medical device that uses eye tracking to non-invasively measure disease severity in people living with MS. Aetna MS, spelled ETNA-MS, is short for Eye Tracking Neurological Assessment for Multiple Sclerosis, and the software assesses MS severity by analyzing an individual's eye movements. As you know, in MS, the immune system mistakenly attacks the myelin sheath that surrounds and protects nerve cells. Well, these attacks can also impact the nerves that communicate with our eyes, leading to changes in our eye movements that are so subtle they aren't easily detected using available imaging techniques. The Aetna MS software is designed to capture these changes in eye movement as a way of monitoring disease progression and cognitive dysfunction. The Aetna MS software has been designed to be used by neurologists in the clinic and by people living with MS at home. The software runs on an iPad Pro, and using it consists of an individual performing a series of simple visual tasks lasting less than 10 minutes. These tasks have been designed to assess key neurological functions that are known to be impacted by MS. From its analysis of these simple visual tasks, the Aetna MS software is able to predict a person's EDSS score with a high degree of accuracy. As a refresher, EDSS is the method that neurologists use to quantify disability in MS. It uses a scoring system of between 0 and 10 to characterize the level of disability in someone living with MS. And the Aetna MS software is designed to predict EDSS scores from 1, reflecting minimal functional changes in one domain, to 4.5, where disability is significant and somewhat limiting, but a person still has daily independence. Any MS specialist will tell you that early intervention is always the best path to the best patient outcome. And the Aetna MS software will allow clinicians and even people living with MS to react sooner to the subtle changes that are captured and analyzed by the software. This means that treatment plans can change more quickly, and that holds the promise of better management of the disease. The regulatory approval by Health Canada is the first in the world for Aetna MS. We'll be watching as other regulatory agencies consider granting approval to this potentially game-changing software. If you'd like to learn more about how the eyes can function as the window to our brain, you may want to listen to the conversation I had just a couple of weeks ago with Dr. Shiv Saida in Real Talk MS, episode number 341. You'll find that link in today's show notes. From identifying MS subgroups by their immune cell signature to tracking eye movements to monitor disease progression, today's episode of the podcast has done a pretty fair job of reminding us of the acceleration of scientific discovery that's been the result of advances in harnessing computing power. Perhaps no single individual has leveraged those advances in computing power to better understand multiple sclerosis more so than my guest, this year's recipient of the Baranczyk Prize for Innovation in MS Research, Professor Sergio Baranczini. Last month at the 2024 ACTRIMS Forum, Professor Sergio Baranczini was honored as this year's recipient of the Baranczyk Prize for Innovation in MS Research. The Baranczyk Prize recognizes exceptional innovation and originality in research, with an emphasis on the potential of the research to lead to pathways for treatment and cures for MS. Professor Baranczini is a geneticist, neuroimmunologist, and data scientist at the University of California, San Francisco. And he's been recognized for his pioneering work in integrating huge amounts of information, often referred to as big data, to understand complex mechanisms that cause MS, and to develop more precise approaches to stop disease progression and end MS through prevention. Welcome to the podcast, Professor Baranczini, and congratulations on being named this year's recipient of the Baranczyk Prize.
Thank you so much, John. It's a pleasure to be here with you today. And I hope we're going to have a great conversation.
I hope as well. The National MS Society points out that we've seen as many advances in MS research in the past 5 years as we saw in the previous 70 years. And when you think about advances in artificial intelligence, genetics, and other areas of scientific discovery, it seems like big data is the engine driving that progress. How has the technology that allows for the analysis of these huge amounts of information impacted MS research?
Well, I really think that it's been transformative. Early in my career, I had the fortune and the good luck to be exposed to this wave of technological innovation that happened in all fields of life, but in particular in biomedical sciences. Around the early 2000s, there was a really leap in our ability to interrogate biological molecules, DNA, proteins, metabolites, in a high throughput fashion that it was simply not possible before. Before then, it was hard, laborious, expensive work that one scientist could do at a time in his or her bench, and it will take months to accumulate enough data to then being able to perhaps in one afternoon, crunch all the numbers and come up with the final statistics before publishing the paper. The paradigm really changed around that time, where now we can get in a single experiment millions of data points almost overnight, so that the experimental work now can be done in a matter of hours or a few days. And then the part of data analysis now takes months because of the complexity and the sheer size of them. So I really think that this changed the paradigm of the scientist in the lab, and it really required computer literacy in our workforce to be able to harness that power that comes with enormous amounts of data, so that we can transform into usable information and hopefully into actionable knowledge.
Well, speaking about harnessing that power, one of the projects that you've devoted, I think, more than a decade to developing is something called Spoke. Can you explain what Spoke is and how it may impact the way MS is treated in the future?
Absolutely. Spoke, the concept of a Spoke is very simple. A Spoke is a database of databases. So we aim at integrating all of the facts that are exposed in openly available databases that the public or researchers consult on a daily or regular basis. But we hope to integrate them into a single platform so that now you can jump from field to field seamlessly and in a computer automated fashion. So what this enables a researcher is saves the time and energy from looking at your favorite molecule or your favorite gene or your favorite disease, and then going to a different database to understand, oh, what might be the symptoms involved in this, and then going to yet another database and what might be the drugs that might be used to treat this disease. In this database, what we call a knowledge graph, in this knowledge graph, every disease is represented. Every single gene in the human genome is represented. There's more than 5 million drugs, small molecules that are represented. Every single symptom, every single pathway, even foods and social determinants of health now have been added. So there's millions, hundreds of millions of facts that are connected via semantic links that we can compute over and that we can visualize in a limited fashion so that we're not overwhelmed through a graphical user interface that we make available for people to use. And that provides the power of, it's like having all textbooks that we go through biomedical school into a single platform. So we can check all the way down to molecules, all the way up to the entire organism, and every way in between. So somewhat integrating the different layers in which biomedicine has been broken into for the sake of understanding the different parts. But now we are bringing everything together to facilitate that interaction across layers of biological complexity.
You are also involved in something else that many of my listeners may not be familiar with. Can you tell us what the MS Genetics Consortium is about?
Absolutely. The MS Genetics Consortium is an international effort from more than 40 different groups around the world that realized about 20 years ago now that if we ever going to find out what the genetic causes of MS are, we have to work together. It's impossible for any individual group, no matter how good the group is, to harness the number of participants that are needed for a genetic study, which is usually in the tens of thousands. So the only possible way to do this is by creating a consortium in which we all contribute both practically, intellectually, and personally into bringing in samples, analyzing them, funding the research, and ultimately publishing the results as a consortium with no individual names listed in the main paper. And that has been something unique about the IMSGC, because it really put the science in front. And we were extremely successful over the last 20 years as a consortium, identifying ever-increasing number of genetic associations that contribute to MS susceptibility, with the latest effort being published in 2019, where more than 200 genomic associations were identified. So the consortium has been an example of collaboration and success in MS genetics throughout the world.
I see some parallels, actually, between Spoke and the MS Genetics Consortium. It seems like in both cases, you've taken information and or work that is being done individually in different places by different people for different reasons and created sort of unifying entities that pull things together.
Absolutely. And I really think that that has been a theme, the thread throughout my scientific career. Bring people together, because I really think that modern science is big data driven. And in order to do that, we need to be collaborative. So the only way to tackle big problems is to do it in a multidisciplinary way with researchers that not only are dedicated and smart, but also experts in different aspects of the disease, so that then together we can bring all those aspects into a unified model that can explain better the complexities of a disease like multiple sclerosis. So I really think that big science is collaborative science.
And to that point, I think about 8 months ago, you published a landmark paper identifying a genetic basis for progressive MS. What can you tell me about that research?
Yes, and that is another success of the International MS Genetics Consortium. Again, we just happen to be the lead analytical side of this effort, together with Dr. Adil Haroun, who was a fellow in my lab at the time, and Dr. Stephen Saucer, who's a professor at Cambridge University. And what we tackle on this particular study is the question of, once MS is diagnosed in an individual, what makes him or her progress at different rates? We've observed an enormous amount of heterogeneity in the severity of the disease. Some individuals might be needing walking assistance 3 years after diagnosis, whereas some others may be still running marathons 10 years after diagnosis. So to what extent is that variability that we observe in the people with MS genetically determined? And in order to do that, we needed to collect a large number of DNA samples from individuals alongside details about the disease course in these individuals, namely the severity and the duration of the disease. With that information, we could then run a genetic study looking at what are the common DNA variants that may correlate or associate with the severity as we defined it. And we were fortunate to be able to have enough statistical power to detect a single signal in chromosome 2 that associates very strongly with the severity of the disease, so much so that individuals who inherit that particular DNA variant in a homozygote fashion, meaning they had both copies of these variants, one from mom, one from dad, these individuals, unfortunately, will develop this ability, namely an EDSS of 6, almost 4 years earlier than individuals who do not inherit this variant. So we think that this is a very significant finding, and we think that there's more to be discovered, but this will pave the way to a new kind of therapeutics that will specifically address the issue of disease severity rather than susceptibility, as it has been the case so far.
Last question. I'm wondering if you have any thoughts you can share on being named this year's recipient of the Barancic Prize.
Well, I'm incredibly honored by this recognition, but I want to make it clear, as I always say, this is a recognition, it's a personal recognition, but in fact, is a teamwork. I'm incredibly grateful to the great trainees that have worked in my lab for more than 20 years now, and to the great collaborations that I've been able to craft over the years with colleagues from all around the world. And again, I think this is a tribute to collaboration and to true scientific discovery. We're doing what the best we can to harness the power of different data modalities, genetics, immunology, neuroscience, put them all together. And this is the result of collaborative science. So I'm incredibly honored by this recognition. And this gives me strength and stamina to wake up every morning and come back with all the energy to the lab to continue making discoveries for MS people.
Professor Sergio Baranzini, thank you for your ongoing work creating a scientific path that leads to new insights, discoveries, and ultimately new and better treatments for MS. Talking to you makes me feel very excited about the future. Thanks so much for talking with me today.
Thank you so much, John. It's been a pleasure.
That's going to wrap up this episode of Real Talk MS. Real Talk MS is powered by the National MS Society. And you can share this episode of the podcast by letting your friends or family members know that all they have to do is point their web browser at realtalkms.com/344. You'll find that link in today's show notes, so you can easily copy and paste it right into an email or a text. And if you have a minute, I hope you'll visit the Apple App Store or the Google Play Store and download the free Real Talk MS app for your iOS or Android smartphone or tablet. It's the best way for us to stay connected. The app will automatically download the latest episode of Real Talk MS. You'll be able to access any of our past episodes. You'll be able to save your favorite episodes. And it's a great way for me to share bonus content with you. The app is free, so I hope you'll download it today. I'm John Strum. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and make healthy choices.